Welcome to The Blast Zone, the podcast where we dig up the bombs that shook Hollywood and try to find out why they went up in flames. This week, if only this movie could use mitosis to multiply the amount of money it made. This is Evolution. Welcome, welcome to The Blast Zone.
Welcome to The Blast Zone.
We are not a podcast about bad movies. We are a podcast about movies that did badly.
That's right.
I am John Drake, in-house film critic of my Letterboxd account.
And I'm Ian Dukes. I'm a person with thoughts and feelings, and some of them are about movies.
Movies like Evolution. To clarify, the 2001 Evolution. I know there was a movie in 2015 with that name. That was not a bomb. We're talking about the 2001 David Duchovny, Ivan Reitman special.
The classic.
But before we get into that, we usually throw this at the end of the episode. If you guys are listening and enjoying the show, we'd really appreciate if you could leave us a review or a rating on whatever platform. Spotify is letting you do ratings now. Apple Podcasts lets you do ratings and reviews, and that just helps other people find our podcast.
We really appreciate it.
We would, but that's enough of that. Ian, how are you doing this week?
You know, I had a whole thing prepared, a little snarky spiel about how summer is back and so is my chronic sinus infection, and that was going to be all Debbie Downer. And you know what? I said, fuck that, because I'm just soldiering on. None of this matters. That was just going to be too annoying. So I'm throwing out the Ian that brought that kind of attitude, and I'm bringing positivity to our show today. How are you doing?
Well, that's awesome. I'm glad you're bringing the positivity. I'm going to try to match your energy levels there. I'm doing good. We're recording a day earlier than usual because I am going to brew at the zoo tomorrow.
What?
Yeah, at the Bronx Zoo. I'm going to drink beer and maybe fight a bear. I don't know. See how drunk I get.
Damn, they let you do that?
If you pay extra, they get the VIP passes. They'll let you fight whatever you want. But, you know, if you only get like the regular VIP pass, the best they can do is a penguin.
Oh,
they're pretty easy to beat.
Not much challenge, but hang out in the penguin enclosure keeps your brewski cold.
Yeah, it's supposed to be pretty warm tomorrow. That would be a nice place to hang out. No, I'm not going to fight any animals. I love animals before people start getting mad at me. But yeah, brew at the zoo. I was supposed to go 2 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And then something happened. I don't remember what was going on, but no. It didn't come to fruition. They kept pushing it back, and eventually whatever day they picked, I couldn't make. So this is my first time actually attending. I'm excited.
That sounds really fun. You have to report back.
I haven't been to the Bronx Zoo in a few years. I used to go at least once a year. So I think we only get like an hour or two where the animals are actually out and about, and then they go to bed for the night.
Sure.
Party. But yeah, it'll be fun. Going with some friends. My sister's going to be there.
Nice.
Well, it'll be a good time.
Sounds lovely.
Well, I'll let you guys know how it is next week. But did you happen to watch anything this week that you thought would be fun to share with the listeners, Ian?
I did. I watched something that's very different from this week's movie. A little something called The Outfit just popped up online recently. It's a 2022 movie. It was just in theaters for a short span, and now it's streaming only on Peacock, for which I'm still inexplicably paying for a subscription, and I'm trying to make use of the money I'm spending. Anyway, first-time director Graham Moore is the co-author and director of this. He wrote the Oscar-winning script for The Imitation Game, a guy who kind of knows his way around a screenplay. It is a really interesting little movie. I say little because it's about an extremely mild-mannered English tailor who has a little tailor shop in 1950s Chicago and gets pulled into some drama with some mobsters, but the scope of it's very small. It feels like a stage play. They do not leave his tailor shop. There's three little rooms in this tailor shop, and that's all you see. And it feels like a stage play. You have to get on that wavelength where it's like a slow burn drama. There's not a lot of action. There's a little action. Not saying it's boring. And there's some really nice performances. Mark Rylance is the star. Some cool supporting parts from Johnny Flynn, who I really liked in Emma, and Dylan O'Brien, who I'm not sure how I felt about from American Assassin, where he played off our boy Taylor Kitsch.
And Zoe Deutsch. You can't forget about Zoe Deutsch. One of my faves.
Is she one of your faves? I thought there was a Zoe Deutsch connection. And she was good. Everyone is solid in it. And it's a fun little thing. So you have to be in that mood for like, not spectacle, but it's a quality nugget. I recommend it.
Yeah, Zoe Deutsch was in Buffalo, which I gave some props to on a previous episode. She was the star of that. But yeah, no, I've been interested in this movie for a while, but I haven't had a chance to check it out yet. So based on your recommendation, I probably will. I'm just finding myself in a show hole, not the kind where you have no shows to watch, but the kind where you have too many.
Sure.
Which is making it tough to find time to just watch movies for pleasure. But I watched a movie that has more in common with this week's film than you might think. I watched Jackass 4.5.
Interesting.
I am a huge Jackass fan. I don't know if I should be admitting that to many listeners, but...
Well, it's out there now.
Actually, you know what? Fuck it. I'm not going to be ashamed of it. I love Jackass. There's something weirdly wholesome about it. I don't understand why I find these guys just destroying their bodies and each other so heartwarming, but I almost feel like I grew up with them. Maybe that's part of it. But watching this, I was struck by the change in Johnny Knoxville's speech pattern. I feel like he's slowed down a lot in recent years, and it made me pretty sad to see. It's done in a documentary style where every stunt or bit is introduced by a talking head, and Knoxville as the face of Jackass is heavily featured in it. And just considering all the traumatic brain injuries he's had, I had to wonder if maybe CTE is starting to creep into the conversation with him.
Wow, that's a dark thread.
It is. For these movies that have always brought me such joy, it laid a little bit of a shadow over it all.
Oh, now you turned this thing that I thought was just Jackass nonsense into something wistful and sad.
I know. It made me sad. As much as I love these movies and these stunts, it made me feel like maybe they should call it a career and wrap it up, which I've always been on the hook for more Jackass stuff. I don't know. He's such a lovable character, somebody who's been around Hollywood for as long as he has. I don't think I've ever heard a bad story about him being inappropriate. So I'm still trying to work out my feelings for it because I had a great time watching and I laughed heartily and enjoyed myself. But now, like, it stuck with me and I can't shake it.
I guess if you feel like you grew up with those people and now you're seeing them age and life take like a real toll on them, that's a compelling drama underneath the silliness.
I got to meet a bunch of them, not Bam and Johnny Knoxville. It was more like the B-tier team. Okay. Did a Jackass tour many years ago, and I worked at Pacific Sunwear. My boss had a skateboard company and he donated a bunch of skateboards that they needed for their show. So they came to Pac Sun to pick them up and hang out. And I got to meet a bunch of them.
Oh.
Very cool. It was like a very exciting moment for 16-year-old me.
You know what that sounds like? A John Tidbit.
Ooh, Tidbit.
You did a genuine tidbit right there.
Look at this. I'm getting in on the fun. But the reason I said it's not that different from the movie we're watching today is because a lot of Jackass is based on scatological humor, dick jokes, and just being wildly immature. Uh-huh. And the movie we got today is wildly immature. It's Evolution, like we mentioned. Did you know anything about this movie? Did you remember when it came out? Had you seen it before? Were you the script supervisor?
I had no official role on this film, to my recollection. But as a one-time X-Files fan back in the day, I kind of remembered that Duchovny came out in an alien comedy. And then I looked at the poster art and I recognized the three-eyed smiley face thing on there. I'm like, yeah, that's familiar. But I never did see it. So this is like a true new old stock movie for me.
But you were aware of its release and it had a pretty big budget and a decent sized release. I did go see this in theaters when it came out. I was a sophomore in high school. Or no, I was a freshman in high school.
Okay.
And I loved it at the time. This movie was a favorite of me and my friends. We got the DVD when it came out and we would watch it at my friend's house pretty regularly. And then, like so many of the movies I talk about on here and the stories I tell, as you got older and your taste changed, I just forgot about it until perusing lists of the biggest box office bombs of every decade, looking for inspiration for the podcast. And lo and behold, I came across Evolution. I was like, well, that would be a fun one to talk about. I bet it's still great today. And we're going to dig into it and find out if it is. But I'm curious, if you guys are listening to this episode, drop us some comments on Twitter, because I want to know if I'm alone in remembering this movie very fondly, because it was a big deal for me when it first came out. And if you're of a similar age and generation, I wonder if that's a shared experience or if I was the idiot.
No, I could totally see. This is a movie where I warmed up to it a little bit on my second watch, because on my first watch, I was pretty turned off. But, you know, the things that turn you off about this movie are not the things that you would really complain about too much as a high school freshman. The humor's kind of sophomoric. It's dumb. It's easy. And it's not very well set up. And then the story kind of doesn't do anything. But if you just want to see the spectacle of it and the slapstick of it, there's some of that in there.
And I will also say that a lot of the problems with this movie were just problems with the late 1990s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not the sole offender, and we probably weren't holding things accountable in the same way we are nowadays. So, fair warning, there's some stuff in this movie that would not fly today. But that's true of, I think, the vast majority of movies we watch from this time period.
And even in its day, it's Ivan Reitman trying to recapture glory from over a decade earlier when he was making Ghostbusters movies. And so he's already sort of creaky by the time this comes out. And the humor has some of that creakiness of like cheap stereotypes and some kind of basic stuff that you're like, I wish they would have found something more clever or creative to do in a lot of these places.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem with this movie, and we'll get into it more when we go through the storyline, is he tried to do two Venkmans.
Yeah.
You can't have two Venkmans. You need one Venkman.
No, you can have two Jakes, as Chinatown proved, but you cannot have two Venkmans.
Did it prove that, though? Did it? Does anyone remember the fucking two Jakes?
No, I don't. I've never seen the two Jakes.
It was directed by Nicholson himself, wasn't it?
Was it?
Thought so.
Okay, showbiz wisdom is now, don't do two Venkmans and also don't do two Jakes.
Yeah, you can do three Michael Keatons in Multiplicity, but two Jakes is no good. Two Venkmans is no good. Three Spider-Men work too. They're okay.
Three Spider-Men, yeah, surprisingly successful, but be careful when you double up on your characters.
Is the moral of the story triples are okay? If they had three Venkmans, it would have been fine?
The rule of three. Classic comedy mistake. You got to use the rule of three.
All right, we solved the puzzle.
Are we saying that Sean William William Scott should have been the third Venkman in this movie, and it would have been great.
Can he play a Venkman? Or could he at this point in his career? I don't think he has the smarminess.
I don't know what he has. We will dive into him. I'm very curious about how this character and his characters overall evolved. I'm no Sean William Scott expert. Maybe you can fill me in.
Did you just call me a fucking Sean William Scott expert? I am so offended right now.
You have expounded upon his growth as an actor previously on this pod. It's documented.
I am a medium fan of his work. Okay. I think he's fine. No, but I do think my advice to everyone who wants to understand Sean William Scott's range more is to watch Goon, because he leans into a lot of the same tendencies he has in movies like Road Trip and, of course, American Pie, and this one, The Rundown, where he's like a goofy, loose cannon kind of idiot, but also expands on that and adds a little depth. And I don't know, maybe he just needed some lines on his face and to mellow out and just soften some of the sharp edges of his performances, because, yeah, they're just much more rounded nowadays.
Yeah, this one's pretty raw. We'll get to some scenes where you're like, what is he doing?
He's not bad, I wouldn't say. He actually does some stuff that I think gives a little shot of adrenaline to the movie at times, but also he has some scenes that I almost had to look away because I was embarrassed.
Agreed.
You know what I'm talking about. We'll get into it, though. All right. Do you want me to talk about the making of this movie?
Yeah, let's hear how this thing happened.
All right. By 2001, The X-Files was wrapping up its original television run, and star David Duchovny had grown tired of playing a wisecracking government agent investigating the supernatural and extraterrestrial. So he signed on to a project in development from esteemed comedy director Ivan Reitman, where he would play a wisecracking former government agent investigating the extraterrestrial.
I can't believe he did that, but I want to believe.
Titled Evolution, Reitman envisioned it as a modern-day successor to the Ghostbusters he had always planned to make. The project had started as a straight-faced science fiction horror thriller from Don Jacoby, which he described as The Thing meets the Andromeda Strain.
Oh cool, a movie where Michael Crichton spends all winter tied to this fucking couch.
Jacoby had experience with horror, having written the scripts for both Arachnophobia and Vampires. That's John Carpenter's Vampires, not just like all vampires, because there's a lot of them. But Reitman hired a writing pair with more comedic stylings in David Diamond and David Weissman to reimagine Jacoby's idea. The pair also absorbed a screenplay from Future Society liver Todd Phillips and Scott Armstrong about three friends who hunt aliens and incorporate it into their draft. Jacoby wasn't happy with the new direction at first, but worked closely with Diamond and Weissman to maintain his original vision.
Of it not being funny.
With a substantial budget of $80 million, equal to about $130 million in today's money, Reitman went about casting, with the aforementioned Duchovny in the lead being joined by Julianne Moore, Orlando Jones, and Sean William Scott. Famously terrible dinosaur supervisor, but excellent creature designer Phil Tippett went about designing the many creepy crawlers needed for the movie.
That must have been a pain in the butt.
Filming began in October of 2000 in Page, Arizona, and wrapped in February of 2001. It was on to post-production, with the film's many special effects shots being handled by Sony Pictures Imageworks and Pacific Data Images. Hopes were high for the movie as it was released in peak summer blockbuster season, with a release date of June 8th, 2001. Reviews were mixed to bad, as it currently sits at 44% on Rotten Tomatoes, and audiences shared the critics' ambivalence towards the movie. It opened in fourth place with $13.4 million, as future episode Swordfish took the top spot, and would limp out of theaters with $98 million in total worldwide gross. Forgotten by most of the movie-going public, a small but dedicated fan base still talks up the movie to this day. I always try to like go to various message boards and movie websites and subreddits and see what's the consensus on this movie now, especially if it's an older one where people's ideas of it may have crystallized a little more over time. And man, there's a sizable community that still loves this movie.
Really?
Your contempt is so visible on your face. I wish people could see you. You look so sad.
I don't know. There's a fan base for every movie. I don't want to take anything away from those fans, but it's hard to get excited. Like, are people still getting excited for David Duchovny? For me, Orlando Jones is a little bit exciting because I didn't get to see him going off in a lead movie role much.
Mostly known as the 7-Up guy, I think, at this point in time, right?
Oh.
You remember those commercials?
I had to look at that again because my 7-Up guy is from a generation prior.
Wilford Brimley. Who's your 7-Up guy?
The guy?
Charlie Chaplin?
Yeah, that's back when commercials were silent.
Fatty Arbuckle just selling 7-Up?
No, the original 7-Up.
Is it the Monopoly Man? That's what I feel like the Monopoly Man would sound like if he had a voice.
Yeah, he had like a Jamaican accent. He was also a Bond villain, I think. I'm not sure who that actor was, but he was like a character.
Ricardo
actor.
Montalban? Oh, no, he was Khan.
He was a Star Trek villain. Hold on. Yeah. Do we have to look this up and settle this now?
Yeah, we might have to.
7-Up guy. Let's see.
Okay. I'm sure if you just type in 7-Up guy, Orlando Jones is going to come up.
Orlando Jones? is coming up, but so is 1983 TV commercial featuring Jeffrey Holder.
That means nothing to me.
I know. Now I have to Google that. Trinidadian actor. Okay, forgive me. He's not Jamaican. He's Trinidadian. He plays a very scary Bond villain. I'm not wrong, because I see the picture of him in the white hat with half his face painted white. One of those Bond movies where he's at a Caribbean carnival parade and he gets attacked.
Was he like the main Bond villain or like an auxiliary?
He was more like a henchman because he's a big, tall, intimidating guy.
Okay. Well, Orlando Jones was famous for the 7-Up. They had a very late 90s marketing campaign where the front of his shirt said make 7 and the back said up yours. Okay. So it was like everyone was getting mad at him when he would walk past them because they'd read his shirt and it said up yours.
That's a good joke.
It's a good joke. They kind of ran it into the ground. Sure. But I do agree with you that he is an actor I've always thought could do really good things if given a chance. And, you know, he did put in a good performance in American Gods, if you watch that show.
Yes, I liked him as Mr. Nancy.
Yeah, he was quite good in it.
Really cool.
But I guess he didn't have a great time on the production. I remember there was some hubbub around his,
that's too bad,
his being written off the show. But yeah, he's an exciting actor. And I don't think he's bad in this. I think the character he's playing is wildly unpleasant.
At times.
At times.
Yeah, he's got his charming moments. And then they give him some lines. You're like, oh, fuck, why'd they make him say that? That was gross or weird or whatever.
Yeah, there's two or three lines from this movie that I just texted you, the actual dialogue. And it was just like exclamation points and question marks. Like, yeah. What the fuck are they doing?
Yeah.
But we'll get into those as they come up. Do you want to start talking about the story?
Yeah, let's jump in. We talked about 7-Up for a while, which is what we usually do at the top of the show for 10 or 20 minutes.
And yeah, it's our soft drink review section. Not just review, but the history of,
history of the
various spokespeople. Yeah.
And now I guess we'll talk about the movie. Here we go.
Fine.
So one night, a meteor lands in the desert of Arizona, nearly hitting wannabe firefighter Wayne Gray, played by Sean William Scott. Then two sleazeball community college teachers drive out to examine the meteorite. Geologist Harry Block, played by Orlando Jones, and his friend, biology professor Ira Kane, played by David Duchovny. Ira finds a primitive form of alien life, and he soon realizes it's rapidly evolving. The next day, the professors bring their classes back to the crash site and marvel at how far the alien life has advanced in a short time. Meanwhile, Wayne Gray starts spotting little alien creatures at the country club where he works. The professors go back again to the crash site, but this time, the U.S. Army is there. We learn that some years back, Ira was drummed out of the Army after he attempted a reckless medical experiment with disastrous results. His ex-boss, General Woodman, and a scientist named Allison Reed, played by Julianne Moore, have taken over all aspects of the alien investigation, and they kick Ira and Harry off the crash site.
All right, so I feel like saying one night a meteor lands in the desert is shortchanging the intro to this movie. We got to give a little background on what's going on when the meteor crashes. We're, I think, intentionally disoriented and misled a little bit. We see Sean William Scott playing Wayne Gray dragging a female body out of a car into a shed in the middle of the desert, essentially. And it becomes apparent quickly that this is not a real person, but a doll. And then he puts on his firefighting fireproof jacket. You're like, okay, I see what he's doing now. He's practicing for something.
That's generous. I mean, you do figure it out, but you don't know that he's a trainee. He's just being a weirdo.
He's being quite weird.
He's burning a CPR dummy. He's telling this whole story about the lady and she smoked in bed and I'm got you. He's acting out the life of a heroic firefighter and he pulls her out of the burning shed and tells everyone to stand back. Well, there's nobody there. He's just having this little firefighter fantasy.
Why is the shed in the middle of? Did he build this shed just to burn it down? Is this on somebody's property? I have a lot of questions here.
The shed is covered in graffiti. It's definitely like a place where the kids go to drink and make out.
And now he's robbed them of that.
Because he had to practice for his test, which he's going to fail because the meteor kind of changes his plans, keeps him up all night, and he's a little bit sleepy when the test happens the next day.
I felt legitimately bad for him when he failed the test because he was sleepy, though, because he really did seem to have his heart set on being a firefighter.
Yeah, you do feel sorry for him, even though the moment you meet him, he's being weird. He's being Sean William Scott. And this is what I wanted to get to. Was he known to be the cool? Like, this was his second movie, maybe? Didn't he debut?
I think he had Road Trip already. You know what? Fuck it. We have the internet at our fingertips. Let's look it up. Because I think he had a couple under his belt. But you are correct in saying, I don't think he had any role up to this point where he was doing anything other than basically playing this person.
And I went back and looked at some Stifler scenes because it's been decades since I saw American Pie. And even Stifler feels like a more grounded character. And then after that, in this, and then we had him in The Rundown, he's being the guy, he's the kooky guy. He's, oh, is that guy crazy? Why is he acting that way, guy? And I'm like, damn, he got typecast fast. And they're actually writing, like, you wouldn't write these behaviors for any other character but a Sean William Scott character. And I'm like, how did he define that so fast within 2-3 years?
So this was 2 years after American Pie came in 99, but then he also had Final Destination in 2000, where he's playing a very similar character.
Okay.
Road Trip, where he is essentially playing Stifler again. Okay. And Dude, Where's My Car was already out.
Oh, damn. Okay.
So I think what happened with Sean Liam Scott, to answer your question about like why was he playing all these type of characters, is, and it's not fair to him because I don't think he's a dumb guy. I think casting directors and directors thought he could only play dumb. Yeah. And when you're playing dumb, there's not that many ways you can go with it when they're going to be a main character. You either have them be an asshole and a bully like Stifler, or his character in Road Trip, whose name escapes me because he's just Stifler. Or you can have him play like Dude, Where's My Car? Dumb, but innocent.
Yeah,
charming. This movie kind of doesn't pick a lane. He's leaning more into the dumb but innocent, but then there's a few moments where he's like nasty, like he's kind of evil.
Yeah, when he's the surly country club worker, he lets his mean side come out.
So, and then I think it took a few years for people to realize he could do more than that. And I think to give him a little more credit in The Rundown, his character's not dumb in The Rundown. He's a little crafty, a little wily.
Yeah.
He's definitely unpredictable and he still has that aspect going for him. But I think he was starting to finally break out of that shell of being typecast as the super dumb guy, whether he's the dumb bully or the dumb, lovable idiot.
Maybe it's his eyes, though. His eyes are wild. And so you just want to give him lines where you're like, is this guy losing it right now? And
yeah,
it kind of works.
But his eyes are a little less wild now, too. Like the twinkle's gone from him. That's what happens when we get old.
Yeah.
We lose our twinkle.
Yeah, my twinkle's long gone.
Yeah, mine's on its way out. So a fair question, though. Like, why was he getting cast in all these roles? And he was, first of all, he was good at it for the most part. In this movie, there's a few spots where he's more missed than hit. And also, you might be onto something that nobody thought he had it in him to be subdued. So he just kept being the wild man.
But I think what you proved in that little bit of quick research is he did a lot of work in a couple of years. And so he was just like, no, give me the next role. I don't care if it's the same thing I just did. I'm working, I'm doing right. The roles. And then so he cemented that typecasting for himself through incredibly hard work and just be like, what's the next one? I'm doing it.
You just hope he was banking that money and investing wisely because the roles slowed down, but not completely. He's still working. He's still relatively busy. He's getting jobs, but I'm sure the money's not what it was.
Well, we think we like him overall. I wanted to comment on this opening scene because there's some excitement. As we mentioned, this is a big budget movie. They spent some of that budget on this first explosion. Sean William Scott is running for his life when he sees the meteor headed straight forward. Him, blows his car into the air, and he proves that he's definitely not a cool guy because not only does he turn back to look at the explosion, he shrieks and he falls down.
You're right to say that this scene looks like they spent a pretty penny on it, but it also reinforces to me how slapdash the production seems like it was, because I'm not one of these guys that's going to sit here and point out continuity errors nonstop, because I think that gets tiresome and it's also, it's a fucking movie. But his car gets blown to pieces and then the next day it's just banged up but still drivable.
It's comedy drivable. It's not really, but yeah, they flip it over and there's enough of it holding together.
Like there's no windshield on that car when it flips and then the next day it still has a windshield. So like it's a big budget movie. You think you'd pay attention to some of that stuff. Everyone should just pay somebody to be like the continuity supervisor.
I feel like they do.
You would know. You probably were that on a few movies that we're going to cover
now. I've been that on hundreds of movies. And yeah, they never listen to me. They go, well, it's for the joke. We need to put him back in the car.
I had a big problem with that in King of the Monsters because that was a very big budget movie made by people who supposedly love the franchise. Don't get me started on King of the fucking Monsters. I'm losing sight of what we're here for. Let's get into Duchovny because strange move having us meet our hero while he's humiliating a couple of simpletons.
Yeah.
Just outright embarrassing them in front of all their classmates and also showing us that he's terrible at his job. He doesn't care.
He really doesn't care. He's super jaded, burned out, and he's reveling in that when we meet him telling the class that they all got A's because he doesn't have time to work hard as a $17,000 a year community college professor.
$28,000 in today's money. I looked it up.
Still not great. Yeah. Then those two brothers speak up. And they go, well, we only got C pluses. And then he has to rub their noses in why they're lucky they didn't fail.
Yeah, Michael Bauer and Ethan Suplee. Ethan Suplee, the super jacked Ethan Suplee now. Yes. Shouts to him. He got in tremendous shape.
Yeah, he is someone who has transformed his physical stature.
You might think that's the end of them, but no, they come back in the third act of the movie for some fucking reason.
Oh, yeah, they're with us the whole time.
But setting up right away that Duchovny as Ira is a sleazebag and kind of a shithead.
And it's the Venkman thing, right? It's this sort of jaded, self-interested, snarky thing. And Duchovny is fine. I don't want to make this into a thing where I'm like, oh, Duchovny fucked this up. He actually, I think, handles all the stuff that he's given pretty well. But the character, I don't know, it lacks some charm. It's too much smarm and not quite enough charm on both of them. Because like you said, he and Harry Block are both pretty smarmy. And you're just like, eh, but do I want to hang out with these guys? We're forced to. We get in the car with them. We go out and check out a meteor site. But like, we're not sure we want to be with them for half the movie at least.
Yeah, and that brings us to our other Venkman, Harry Block, played by Orlando Jones, who we meet. And this was an interesting scene because he is talking to a female student who is attractive, played by Catherine Town, the future former Mrs. Charlie Hunnam. But we get the impression that maybe she's trying to flirt with him to get some help, and he's rebuffing her at first. So we're like, oh, maybe he's virtuous and he's going to be a little more straight-laced of the two. But then it flips at some point, and like when she's not looking, he starts making these like gestures towards her for Ira's benefit when Ira enters the room. And you're like, oh no, he's also like a skeevy shitbag.
He so flips back and forth in that one scene. That's a good observation, because yeah, they could have gone one way with them where you like think, oh, here's the guy trying to make time with the hot student who's obviously trying to use her wiles on him to improve her grade so that she can get into nursing school, not because she wants to be a nurse, because she wants to impress the Miss Arizona judges. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
I got tired halfway through saying the one sentence it took to explain that. I got totally exhausted and decided I didn't
want to. I know, I could see it in your face
anymore.
Talk about the sparkle leaving your eye.
It's gone, man. It's gone.
Yeah, but like that's a thing with Harry throughout the movie. It's never more evident than in this scene, because like you said, it literally goes back and forth in one scene. But there are times when you're like, okay, this guy's serious and he seems like a decent enough dude. And then there are other times where he says lines that are just abhorrent and you're like, who is this guy? Like, it's the two Venkmans thing. Neither of them are clever or witty enough to play it off either. And also, I have a real problem with Ira did Tuskegee, essentially.
Yeah, we learn more about it at the start of Act Two. Maybe we'll dig into just how vile his history is as an experimental scientist, but they don't do him any favors.
And then he's also very cavalier about it. Like you said, Duchovny's not really the problem. He plays the character as written, but man, the performance you would have to give to transcend what's on the page here would be Oscar worthy, and he ain't that.
Yeah.
But enough about the Tuskegee experiments for now.
We'll dive into that in the next section. But here, the science he does in this first act is the stuff that you like, right? He actually is doing some real science and discovering these little microscopic creatures.
Yeah, they take a sample from the meteor and bring it back to the lab where the meteor is bleeding. They look at this goo sample, and he literally sees these organisms splitting in real time. And I thought it was really cool how the sample grew so fast that it shattered the slide. I was like, that's cool. Yeah. That's a cool little idea.
Yeah, neat little
That's script. Something that feels like it was probably in Jacoby's original script, because I could see that being played as a really tense, frightening thing. But the slow dawning realization that these are alien organisms that are evolving rapidly, and what does this mean, and how fast this is all going to happen, that stuff I thought was really cool. And it's a solid premise for a sci-fi horror movie. And I would like to watch that movie someday.
Solid. And I really felt that. So my overarching grand theory of this movie is that it still feels like a horror story, especially in the first half. It feels like a horror story that they punched up with jokes, because like you said, the bones of the plot points of the discovering the aliens and how they start to evolve and the way different versions of them start to leak out into the world, that feels like straight ahead scary sci-fi stuff. And then just on top of that, Sean William Scott's here for some reason, and now they're joking about underage girls, and Julianne Moore is doing pratfalls, and it feels like they just stapled jokes onto this skeleton that's very much a horror story.
Sean William Scott is just falling into a tub of butterscotch for some reason.
But the thing that I realize makes it the most like, oh, this is a horror movie with jokes, unlike in good comedy where the characters have deep problems and strong wants and desires that they're constantly frustrated because they can't figure out how to get out of their own way. This is a horror plot where the characters didn't really want anything when they arrived. Something bad happened to them and they're dealing with it. Like, that's horror movie plot, because you don't expect character growth in horror movies. You just expect some people trying to survive. So that's mostly what's happening. And they staple just enough motivation where they try to tell you that these guys want to get out of their dumb community college jobs and they want to become famous and rich and win the Nobel Prize. But all that feels slapped on. That doesn't relate to anything. Like, was there any moment where you felt like, oh my gosh, I hope that Harry and Ira can finally get the thing they want? Did that ever happen?
No. In fact, the opposite happened, where I was like, these selfish pieces of shit are going to ruin, like, the world is going to end because they want to get rich off this. When the minute they went back to the site and there's fucking flatworms everywhere, it's been like, you got to call the government, man. And they're still like, we don't tell anyone. This is our discovery. What are you going to do with it? It's clearly out of your control. This is way beyond the scope of your powers.
And everyone keeps telling them, you're community college professors, and they're taking that as an insult. insult and they're righteously indignant about it. But when you watch the movie, you're thinking, no, you're right. Get the fucking community college guys out of there. Let's get some serious pros in here and handle this alien invasion.
There's no two professors from any institution that could handle this problem. I don't care where they teach. You need some fucking heavy duty scientists and potentially military in there because the situation is going to get out of hand quick. And I was like, how do they not see that?
Yeah, you need to do exactly what they did, which is lock down the site, put an airlock over it and seal it up, which is a good thing. And I guess you could argue that they're just saying, well, all that's fine, but don't cut us out. You need to let us hang around.
But for what? What do they have to offer? Their whole argument is we got there first. But what do you have to offer this research?
Well, it's butt jokes, for one, and ogling the female scientists. That's what they really bring to the table.
Let's talk about Dr. Allison Reed, played clumsily by Julianne Moore. And I don't mean that her acting's bad. She literally falls down all the time. Apparently a Julianne Moore addition to the character.
Interesting.
I feel like she wanted to do comedy and that there was nothing in the script. So she was like, I guess I just got to fall down.
I can fall down.
She went back to the silent era. Like, what's funny? Physical comedy? I could do that. Because they wrote her the worst character in the history of film.
It's real thin.
The thing with her character I find so strange is the way other people talk about her. I'm like, how do I want to say this? She is one of the points that really crystallizes that this was three scripts fucking thrown together haphazardly. Because there's so many lines, particularly from Harry, where he's like, oh, she's an ice queen. She really needs to get laid. She's so frigid. Also, she wants to fuck you so bad. It's like, well, those two things are at odds. If she's an ice queen, how do you know she wants to fuck Ira so bad? Two, there's nothing in her performance or lines that indicates any of that. She's not an ice queen or frigid at all. She's perfectly pleasant. She just happens to be professional and like want to do her job correctly.
She's not even like a nerdy scientist. She's just like a very normal lady.
She's just a very smart, normal lady.
Yeah. And yeah, they're playing off that, oh, she's a sexually repressed nerd scientist. But not only is she seemed straight down middle of the road normal, the filmmakers apparently forgot that because they threw in the falling down stuff, they threw in this joke about seeing her wearing this fancy garter belt, holding up her stockings when she falls down in front of the boys in the first scene. And that sort of hints that she's actually a little more sophisticated. She's a little more put together style-wise and in charge of her own femininity. Like, she seems like a well-rounded person, partly because of this dumb joke that they threw in that undermined saying this other stuff later. It doesn't click.
It felt like they took this Todd Phillips script, which Diamond and Weissman claim that they don't even remember what was in it and they didn't really use it at all. I don't know that I buy that. Or maybe they feel that way now, but there's definitely some Todd Phillips shit in here, for better or worse. And then they took a Jacoby script and like they mashed together, but then never thought to have a third party look at it and just be like, does this all make sense?
Yeah.
They left lines in from one, but the lines don't make sense narratively anymore. Whatever supporting information was in the previous script, you took that out, but left a line in that refers back to it almost.
It does have some of that feeling. And I hate to crap on the beloved Ivan Reitman, may he rest in peace. He's a beloved figure for all the great stuff that he did do, but it feels like that would have been his job. He was maybe sleepwalking through this movie a little bit because, yeah, he's the one who's supposed to stitch all this together and make it work on the screen, and it doesn't fit together too great.
I think there's probably some blame to be passed around to Mr. Reitman. I'm trying to see. I have a little bit of an inkling. Yeah, he never made a good movie after Kindergarten Cop in 1990. I guess it depends how you feel about Junior. I wasn't a Junior fan, but 6 Days, Seven Nights, Evolution, My Super Ex-Girlfriend, No Strings Attached, Draft Day. Maybe he was mailing it in.
Is that what we said about Draft Day too? That it seemed like...
Draft Day is directed with almost no flair whatsoever. Like, at least Evolution has some ideas. I think Draft Day might be a better movie, but it's directed like a TV movie. It's got nothing going for it in terms of filmmaking. It's just people having conversations in rooms.
Yeah, this has, it's weak and it's watered down, but it's trying to emulate his glory days, so his Ghostbuster days, which doesn't live up.
We will keep bringing up Ghostbusters because Ivan Reitman literally said he wanted to make a modern day Ghostbuster, so it's fair game now.
We're probably going to talk about it less than we could because like you could go point by point and dissect this film and lay out every single parallel to Ghostbusters because there's tons of them and that would just be a little exhausting, but it'll definitely come up.
All right. You ready to move on to the middle section?
Yeah. Let's hear what happens next.
All right. Harry and Ira still crave the fame and fortune of the alien discovery they believe was rightfully theirs. Ira goes to court to be let back onto the investigation, but he loses badly because he's a fucking war criminal. Then when the guys realize the government has confiscated all their samples and data, they decide to break into the crash site to steal something back. But they're caught while exploring the underground cavern, now teeming with alien creatures. One alien bug gets inside Harry's protective suit and ends up having to be surgically removed from his butt. Meanwhile, larger alien creatures begin to appear in the community, one eating a country club guest another biting a suburban woman on the hand. After Ira and Harry and their new friend Wayne confront a dragon-like creature in a shopping mall, they realize the aliens have evolved to thrive in Earth's atmosphere and now threaten all mankind. Help me follow the evolutionary chain here, though. It goes single-cell organism, multi-cell organism, flatworms, bugs, dragons.
Yeah, dragons come before monkeys, obviously, as we know from the history
As we know, right. Paleontologists have long said, first come the dragons, then come the monkeys. Yeah, maps used to say, here be monkeys.
There was a phase of crabs and lobsters in the middle there. Did we talk about that? That's what they find mostly when they go into that cavern.
And the creature with the big ass that they have to sexualize.
Everything's an ass to Harry Block. He can't help pointing it out.
Yep. But the stuff in the airlock is cool.
Like, yeah.
The effects haven't aged fantastically, but they're also not embarrassing.
No, you can tell they went all out for that scene. There's like a nice effect shot that could have been in a Jurassic Park type movie or something really big budget where they're walking into the cave and then a little creature flies into the frame and then the camera follows it and turns around and you see this lush alien jungle full of all these other creatures. And that feels like the big budget, high production value portion of the movie.
And again, pretty much anything with the alien creatures up until the very end and the kind of science discovery aspect of it all is in the wind column for me. I was on board for all that stuff. In the long run, I just ended up being sad because we didn't get more of that.
But I don't know what more of it would have meant. Yeah, it would have meant to just the sci-fi version of this movie where it's just Jeopardy and rescue and fighting creatures.
I just had a thought. Isn't Annihilation just the real sci-fi horror version of this movie?
Yes, that's an excellent thought.
It kind of is, right?
Yeah, that's
just... It's a very eerily similar storyline.
I got to watch Annihilation again. But yeah, it's just alien DNA merging with everything it comes into contact with, right?
And changing very rapidly.
Yeah. Yeah,
expanding uncontrollably. Interesting. That'd be a fun double feature. I think we have Annihilation on the schedule. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, there was probably my biggest laugh in this movie. And I don't know if you even noticed it. It's a very quick thing. But when they're in court, Harry stands up to defend himself and just like smacks Ira in the face very absentmindedly. Like he clearly does it on purpose, but he tries to play it off very nonchalant. And you could tell Duchovny's trying not to laugh during it. I don't know why that got me so much.
When you wrote a note about it, I went back and watched it again. I'm like, oh yeah, I did laugh at that the first time. There's this little part in the middle of the movie where they actually make it work. That comedy duo stuff with the rapid banter and the physical humor. And some of it actually flies. And you go, hey, these guys are funny as a duo. And that's one of the best examples of it, of them in court. Because the whole court scene is dumb. And like you said, it turns tragic when you realize what Duchovny's character actually perpetrated. But for a few moments in there, and at the beginning of the cavern exploration scene, there's also some of that funny banter that harkens back to like old school comedy duos, stars of stage and screen. But then both those scenes devolve into, by the end, you're like, oh shit, get me out of here.
Yeah, it's like the movie wouldn't let them be likable for longer than a few minutes at a time.
Yeah, just be a funny Hope and Crosby kind of pair. And instead, they have to like, oh, now we get gross.
Because they're both actors I enjoy and they work well off each other. But they're so interested in making them repellent to fulfill some kind of anti-hero role that they just decided that they should be in. It's no, man, you didn't have to. You could just have nice protagonists that people like. You took the wrong lesson from Bill Murray, because that's just who Bill Murray is, you know?
Yeah.
It's a very hard balance to strike. And neither of them pull it off. And again, I don't think it's on them because when they're playing it a little straighter and still wisecracking, but like at each other's expense rather than whoever else, Dr. Reed or an alien with a big ass. It's fun. Yeah, it's winning, as you said.
Yeah, there's good parts. That's the part where the film is a little bit less watered down, because one of the things about they took this horror script, sci-fi horror, and then they watered it down. Oh, no, we're putting comedy in here. We're not going to make the aliens scary. So we're going to have the college kids walking through a room filled with gross alien flatworms, but it's not going to be that gross and it's not going to be frightening to them because we don't want to frighten anybody. And then by the time they get to the cavern, you're like, okay, actually it should be frightening. And then you have two guys acting scared and that's when it's fun. Like when he tells them Harry steps on a gross blue lobster and it squirts everywhere and little crab things come out and eat it. And he goes, oh shit, look at all these little things coming out. And Ira goes, snag one. Did you think that part was one of the parts that worked?
Yeah, I wrote that line down. I guess I didn't expand on why I wrote it down, but I was like, that's funny. His reaction is exactly how I would react. In a situation like, snag one? The fuck are you talking about? These things are nightmares.
Yeah, they're horrific. Their only saving grace is that they're all pretty small until a big thing comes down and eats one right on his
There's
face.
No way anyone should be in there for anything at this point, because there are things more than big enough to murder you in there already at this point. But we do have to talk about what Ira did to get himself dishonorably discharged from the military.
Yeah. Take a step back to the courtroom scene where it all comes out.
He was a military, not a general, right? He wasn't a general, was he?
Did they say he was a major or a
colonel? Captain?
He puts his old uniform on so that they can sneak in there later and they talk about what he was. But I get the feeling it was a major, but.
A major, but very apropos. Yeah. And he basically tested a vaccine, which all this reads much worse in 2022 when vaccine skepticism is at unprecedented high for no fucking reason. And it was the Kane madness.
Yeah, Kane madness they called it? Is what happened to these poor unsuspecting soldiers. Apparently 150,000.
Yeah. Yeah. He just ruined these dudes' lives. So when he's first going on to the site in the cavern and it's been taken over by the military, one of the guards letting him in like freaks out and starts screaming at him. And I'd forgotten this subplot completely. I don't know that I ever really grasped it as a kid, like what it was really about. But you're like, why is this guy so mad at it? It's a little intriguing. You're like, oh, there's something here. And then I guess the reveal is monumentous enough, but it's pretty horrifying.
Yeah. If I understood it correctly, that guard is reaching for his pistol to kill Ira Kane on site.
With good reason.
20 years later, to kill this man on site with good reason because he afflicted them with. And then they do it as a comedy bit to force him to admit what the side effects of his vaccine were, which was like comedy side effects. Some of them were
diarrhea,
flatulence. Yeah. But then, it's pretty brutal stuff.
The list keeps going and they get less and less funny as it goes on and more like, oh, like this is serious. This guy did something horrible and he does not seem to have any remorse for it.
No, he's very defiant the whole time, which is actually kind of creepy once you hear what he really did. He's just utter lack of remorse. It's chilling.
I guess you could give a character that backstory and still have them be a hero if they're like, I was just really trying to save people. I thought it was safe. But he's cavalier about the whole thing and it makes it very hard to root for him because it's always been the back of my mind.
Yeah, I guess I had to forget about it because they play it off. The end of that scene, it's just Harry slaps his forehead and goes, oh God, Ira, you really fucked us up. The judge is never going to let us back in there now.
Shouldn't have gave all those people Legionnaire's disease or whatever, which is not what he gave them. I was just thinking of a funny Legionnaire's disease is not funny. You know what I'm trying to say?
No, now we're going to have to raise money for the Legionnaire's Foundation because we accidentally insulted people. That's the danger of covering these movies.
Yeah, so that kind of solidifies the Ira Kane is a terrible person theory I have. It's not really a theory at this point. It's more of a fact.
Yeah, it's all in a court of law. It comes straight out in the deposition.
Like if this was real life, he'd be in a textbook.
Yeah.
About atrocities throughout history.
Dark chapter of American history. Exactly.
Back to the hijinks, I guess, after this.
Yeah, but how about the dark chapter of this movie where they do emergency butt surgery on Orlando Jones?
Butt surgery. We got to talk about butt surgery. Not like the BBLs. We're not talking about Brazilian butt. Butt lifts. We're talking about getting a giant dragonfly / wasp looking thing pulled out of your anus.
And why was it there? No reason.
Why would it make sense to take it out from the anus? I don't think that makes anatomical sense at all from where it enters his body. Well, the way this thing moves around his body makes no sense regardless.
It's moving around under the skin of his thigh, which doesn't even make sense from the beginning. So first of all, it disappears in his suit. And then he looks into camera and crosses his eyes and goes, ooh. And you're like, oh, it may have just gone up his butt or something like that. He just had a freak out moment. And then the next moment, smash cut to him being wheeled into the ER. And you're like, okay, it's in his butt. But then it's, oh no, it's not in his butt. It's just going up and down his thigh.
Which must be extremely painful and gruesome.
It was horrifying,
but
yeah.
If it went in his butt, like you're meant to think it does, I don't know if you know this, but your intestine and your colon do not wrap around your upper thigh. They avoid that area generally.
I Googled that and you are correct.
I'm not a medical doctor, but I know a few things. So it just feels lazy. It's like, all right, you had this idea, but you didn't sit down to like flesh it out. And it sounds, I can't believe I'm saying this about a scene involving a giant dragonfly being pulled out of someone's ass, but just make it make sense on your own terms.
Yeah. It's like they tried to stretch it out. It's like, let's have it come out of the butt and go up and down his leg so that we can do a couple more jokes and escalate the beats up to butt surgery. The whole thing is just artificial. And then when it goes to the butt, you're like, oh no, it went to the butt. And you see them setting up and his jokes about lube. There's no time for lube. There's always time for lube. It's just, it's really heavy handed.
Then when it's all said and done and they pull the thing out of his ass, he asks Julianne Moore for an ice cream cone. And she says, sure, what flavor? And he says, it doesn't matter. It's for my ass. I'm ashamed to admit I chuckled.
It's a testament to how good Orlando Jones is. And actually, there are things you could, if you weren't so offended by the actual content of that scene, we could possibly praise some of the qualities of the acting, of the performances, and the rapid patter lines and the quick editing. It's actually put together pretty decently well. It's just, you just don't want to see it. You're like, no, I see what's about to happen. And I don't want to watch that. But maybe we have to give it a little praise.
This movie's really obsessed with butts.
Yeah.
So then we do see kind of our first Alien in the Wild attack, which isn't bad. You also get the sense that this is a scene that was probably in the original script because it could easily be played much scarier and less slapstick.
You're talking about the dragon in the mall?
I'm talking about the alligator monster at the country club.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a couple alien attacks in this section. And this is also where we see that Wayne, despite being like a sweet little simpleton, is also a piece of shit because a guest at his country club where he's a bartender asks him if he's watering down the Mai Tais, and his response is to be giddy when he turns up dead an hour later.
Well, let me just add something because I realized that is the same country club member who dressed him down for leaving a damp towel on his pool chaise. So I think when you combine those two complaints, that's worth killing.
He deserved to die a horrible, painful death.
Yeah, he's very happy and blasé about the man being eaten up by this little alligator creature.
And the guy, you also get the impression he's cheating on his wife.
Yeah, the victims all have to deserve it, as they do in Hollywood movies. That guy's cheating on his wife. The girl who, in a minute, gets attacked by the dragon, she's shoplifting. So no innocents were harmed in the making of this movie.
What about the suburban ladies? They make that one poor lady open the door. She seems like a pushover of the group. She didn't stand up for herself. We're like Jigsaw right now. You didn't stand up for yourself. Now you must confront the alien dog.
But she's not killed. So because she didn't commit a big enough sin, she only gets her finger bit off or something.
Right. And that scene was gnarly. I remember being a little scared of that scene with the little cute little wrinkly bulldog thing.
You know something's going to go bad. He's so cute and sad and forlorn looking, and then some shit's about to go down.
He's got a little xenomorph guy in his mouth.
Uh-oh.
But yeah, there's a lot of alien attacks here. So let's get to the mall scene, because the mall scene is, aside from the finale, the big set piece of the movie, I would say, right?
Yeah, this is the big second act set piece. Shit is real now, and our heroes are together. The three of them are working as a team, and they have their first real victory. Spoiler alert, they defeat the dragon.
With several $1,000s of illegally obtained shotguns and ammo, you don't get the sense that any of them are hunters. Although we do know that Harry has fired a gun before, because Wayne asks him, "You ever use one of these before?" And he replies in one of my least favorite lines in a movie ever, "Just because I'm a school teacher, don't make me a pussy." What?
Yeah.
First of all,
Orlando, they gave you the tough lines, buddy, and you had to say them.
That's not even the toughest one. It was the volleyball line hasn't passed yet, right? Has that already come and gone?
The volleyball line is just before this.
Jeez, they were really killing him in the second act when Wayne finds out that he's a volleyball coach. He says, "Do you ever get to watch them shower?" Which, creepy, Wayne. And Harry incredulously is like, "Yeah, sometimes I shower with them." And then they never expand on that at all.
You're waiting for him to wink or turn or for Wayne to even do a reaction that reveals, like, was that real? Is he fucking with him? And they move on. Someone else walks into frame and they move over to the other action of the scene.
Act two of this movie is fucking Harry Block character assassination time.
It's bad. We liked him, but he's got problems.
He becomes a little less wholesome. Not that he was wholesome to begin with. And then I know Sean William Scott singing "You Are So Beautiful" to the dragon was a big trailer moment. It popped up in a lot of the marketing materials for this movie.
Makes sense.
And it still gets brought up a lot. Not the singing so much as the ca-ca, ca-ca, tookie-tookie lines, which are not really funny in and of themselves, but I did enjoy Harry's response, which is, I think we've established that ca-ca, ca-ca and tookie-tookie do not work.
Yeah.
Which he delivers very deadpan, and I enjoyed.
That was a good line. Other than that, it's almost like you wonder, did they send Sean out there and like, "Hey, buddy, go do your thing. Do something weird. People like it when you get weird.
Be silly."
Yeah, and that's what he's doing.
And the singing did not work for me. I was embarrassed watching it. I get secondhand embarrassed in scenes like that.
Yeah.
Not that Sean William Scott doesn't have a better singing voice than I thought. He's not bad.
He's fine.
He's pretty good. Also, with this scene, they lose track of the dragon for 30 seconds. And I can't remember which characters. I think it's Harry says to Ira, like, "Should we just pack it in? There's a fucking dragon flying around this mall. You guys are responsible for this because you didn't call the government fast enough, and now these things are spreading, and you just want to go home?"
Like, it's not that big a mall. It's a regular old mall. So, like, the thing keeps flying, and then they just stop in one of the little atriums and go, "Oh, I guess it kept going, and we stopped, so we're not going to catch it."
He's in Brooks Brothers getting fitted for a suit. They're not going to let us in there dressed like this. Might as well just go.
Yeah, the dragon is sitting in the massage chair at Brookstone, and until they kick him out, he's going to be tied up for a while.
Can't disturb him. He's doing that water massage. That thing takes a while. God, I haven't been to a fucking mall.
I'm thinking, what are in malls? He's at the Orange Julius getting a drink.
He's down at the Johnny Rockets. He's getting a milkshake. Are they still a thing?
Probably.
So I think that wraps up the middle act. Do you want to walk us through the final section?
All right, let's bring this baby home.
We spent a lot of time on that middle
act. I know. There's a lot in this movie. Well, let's see what else happens. So Arizona Governor Lewis, played by Dan Aykroyd, is briefed on the alien situation. The creatures have spread throughout a local system of caves. And after a close call with the latest ape-like evolution of the aliens, the governor approves a military firebombing to destroy them all. Unhappy with the destructive approach, Allison leaves the government side and joins forces with the guys. But our heroes realize the army's napalm will only make the aliens grow faster, and so they come up with their own solution, a fire truck filled with dandruff shampoo. Sure enough, when the army attacks, the alien threat...
What the fuck are you talking about?
Hey, look, it will all be explained shortly.
All right.
Sure enough, when the army attacks, the alien threat morphs into a single massive blob monster 100 feet tall. So our heroes drive up with the fire hose and give the creature a shampoo enema. The alien explodes, the threat is over, and our heroes bask in the fame and adoration they craved. Except for Ira and Allison, who sneak off to have sex.
We get a fun scene of the three of them driving. I'll play that funky music White Boy plays. They didn't even bring the dragon with them? They just left it there?
That's the sort of wrap-up of that second act, right? They kill the dragon, and then the three guys drive home, and they're just jamming an old tune and singing along. It's like somebody saw Wayne's World and said, what's a song we can have the characters all sing loudly in the car?
You just saw this creature develop the ability to breathe oxygen. It's over for planet Earth now. You guys are fucked. You just literally caused the apocalypse. And you're just dancing to the song, having a grand old time. Why? Because you think you're going to be let back into the... You guys are still worried about the cave? Like, the world is going to end. How can you not see that? You're fucking scientists.
It's a weird moment.
Once these things can breathe oxygen, it just makes no sense.
Yes, you're applying logic to this movie, and this movie is trying to just win us over with a winning scene with a funky song that everybody remembers from the 70s or whenever that happened. Can't we just enjoy our nostalgia for a moment after killing a dragon in a shopping mall?
There's the Ghostbusters 2 thing with that song, Your Love Is Taking Me Higher. Your love.
Yeah.
But that at least made some narrative sense, because they're like, oh, the goo reacts positively to like the song. It likes upbeat music or whatever. Ghostbusters 2 sucks. I don't remember it that well. But Reitman likes to do these little musical things, but tie it into the narrative somehow. I felt like I was like, this is 2 minutes of my life I'm never going to get back.
Yeah, it wasn't even, there was nothing established, oh, this is one character's favorite kind of music or anything. It was just like, hey, they're in the Jeep. They got to drive back from the mall. Might as well blast an old funk tune.
It's a good song, but
it's okay. It's not my favorite.
And then the monkeys from Congo show up.
Yeah, scary monkeys. Now.
I thought they were silly a little bit, but also scary. I don't know what I think about the monkeys. I feel like it's unnecessary to have them evolve further. Like, they're already dragons. They're already scary.
I liked it. It had that Congo aspect of, oh, they're smart now. They're shutting off the cameras. This is really getting out of hand. It went from medieval kind of fighting into having to fight a smart enemy. And their physicality and their look and stuff, that was fun. And that's the fun stuff that I like, whereas a lot of the movie, the creatures are neutered and they're not that scary. This is where you get humor out of something that's horrifying and makes you shriek, but it can also make you laugh because it was stupid. I feel like that's where it started to hit a note that made sense, and the comedy actually worked a little better when the silver blue apes were killing army men.
Yeah, but there was also like a very puppety aspect to them, because the way they swing their arms around is like wildly, and they have no, like, they can't bend their arms at all.
I like that about them. Yeah, that
but it looks like they almost have no impact when they land. It's very, it's like soft, just kind of flopping it down on them. Yeah. But they were not a total miss for me. I am an apologetic Congo fan. Uh-huh. So anything with a silver monkey, I'm into. Then the governor shows up, played by Dan Aykroyd. And he's fine, but he's like General Patton. Why is the governor so militarized? He's the governor of Arizona. And also, why is the governor of Arizona the highest ranking official who's brought in the loop on this? And why can he command the U.S. military?
Good question. Excellent question. He is the turquoise Native American jewelry wearing governor of Arizona. They make a point to show this jewelry that he's wearing. So he's very provincial. And yet, yeah, here's this high-ranking U.S. Army general. And he's like, no, I'm in command here.
In the real world, this guy would have been quietly shot in the head behind a building and like, oh, no, we got to hold a special election now. And second of all, by the time he shows up, you would need a global coalition of all the established countries in the world working on this problem to be like, we got to fucking fix this now. The president finds out about this with like 7 minutes left in the movie, which is just absurd to me. And I know it's supposed to be a comedy, but why does it have to be a stupid one?
Well, you know, we're spoiled with smart sci-fi, and you and I both like hard sci-fi. We're like, oh yeah, what would really happen is you need to get all the nations of the earth working together.
I'm not saying it needs to be a rival. Just make it a little bit on the level.
A little nod. Yeah, their version of that was call the president. Well, there's got to be phones on Air Force One. Why can't we reach the president? And that was just like a half-hearted, weak attempt.
Yeah, he should have been notified. And first of all, for the funding they needed to set up this fucking super lab next to the canyon, you best believe you would have had to get that approved up the ladder federally.
Like, you could have had the Secretary of Defense or somebody who's a national figure taking charge here. But it was Dan Aykroyd. He had his heart set on being a governor, so they let him be the governor. I don't know.
The stupidity continues because, first of all, they have had samples of these creatures for weeks at this point, if not like a month. They didn't think to find out how to kill them in that time. What is PETA involved? Fucking aliens. And they're growing rapidly and uncontrollably. You don't think maybe we should start testing out some theories and see if they can be killed and how?
The U.S. Army literally demanded jurisdiction, took over the site, and yet then they acted like it was a pure research science project. They're like, oh yes, we're preserving the aliens perfectly in this airlock and we're studying them. What about trying to protect yourself from them in the first place?
Once they started growing at the rate where you're like, oh, we can't contain them, they're rapidly approaching that point. And also, it's the U.S. government. Like, they never hesitate to torture and kill things.
It's out of character for them to be these innocuous research scientists until the last minute.
They're being dumber than any real government agency would be, and that's saying a lot. And then the scientists are being magically smarter than any scientist ever could be, because Ira just comes up with this fucking half-assed harebrained theory about how to kill them by looking at the periodic table on Julianne Moore's t-shirt. And it's like, oh, well, we're oxygen-based. And if you go what, two down and one over, you see arsenic, which is poisonous to us. They're nitrogen-based, which is a fact I just spit out, even though it's not mentioned anywhere else in the story, because it's going to help me make my point.
Right.
So if we go two down and one over from nitrogen, we have selenium, which is a anti-dandruff thing that's not even in Head and Shoulders at this point in time. It was not the active ingredient in Head and Shoulders. Zinc is the active ingredient in Head and Shoulders.
Yes.
And it was the active ingredient in Celsin Blue.
Celsin Blue, it's right there in the name.
Celsin Blue said, no, you can't use our brand in your movie. So they changed to Head and Shoulders. And then Head and Shoulders eventually came out with a clinical strength version that does use selenium as the active ingredient. They did way too much fucking dandruff shampoo research for this podcast. But it's just, that's so fucking half-assed. And then they don't even think to go get one bottle of Head and Shoulders and spray it on the alien organism in their lab.
Oh yeah, they're going to see totally if it works. Blind. They're like, it's just based on what Ira threw out there. So I have a theory about this scene, which is it's so thin. The science is thin. The place where Ira comes up with it in the middle of nowhere. It's like the other college bros are handing everyone beers and he just interrupts them and goes, wait a minute, oxygen, arsenic, selenium. He starts spouting this stuff out of nowhere. And he's looking at the back of Allison's shirt, which has this periodic table on it. And I'm like, oh, they watered this down. This was a joke where he was staring at Allison's boobs. She happened to have the shirt with the periodic table on the front. And so he turned that into his moment of discovery. And it was going to justify their whole over-sexual fixation of these characters and turn it into, oh, that's how they save the world. It's because he stared at her boobs long enough and he had a brilliant idea.
I hope Julianne Moore was the one who said no to this idea.
That's what I felt like. She said, you guys, I'm uncomfortable with this. And Ivan Reitman's like, you know what? You're right. Put the shirt on the other way and he'll just spot it on the back of your shirt while he was staring at your shoulder blade.
Yeah, I'm sure Julianne Moore has lovely shoulder blades.
I'm sure too. But do you think that could have been?
Oh, no, that seems totally plausible. That feels very much like a joke this movie would make that it pulled back from at the last minute. And I don't know if that's a better reveal, like, because when all is said and done, it's still some of the dumbest theorizing. And just test your fucking theories, man. I know the scientific theory. Again, I'm not a scientist, but I went to high school. Do an experiment. You got a fucking alien blob in the corner of your lab right there. You got a grocery store or a drugstore up the block.
Yeah.
Just go buy a bottle of fucking shampoo and test it out first. Don't fill up a fire truck with it and hope it works.
But suspense.
It would take you 15 friend. Minutes.
The whole suspense would be over and then it would just be an obstacle instead of a true suspenseful ending, which it wasn't anyway, because it was just another butt joke, but.
Also, why does the military need like 5,000 ground troops to napalm a cavern?
That was some cheesy stuff. The ground troops showed up with just rifles to fight possibly a horde of alien silver apes. And yet, yeah,
there are still other types of aliens because they're not.
Oh, yeah. And still some legions of dragons and who knows what else. And they're just walking around on foot through the desert. There's not a tank to be seen. There's not an aircraft. There's
straight up infantry.
It's just some grunts. Just walking around the desert, stumbling around.
Like, it's like if you had the little green plastic soldier toys. They were like, give me like 10,000 of the guys with the phone and just throw them out there. I'll see what they could do.
They'll call each other. Do you see any aliens? No, I don't see them yet.
Well, now that just reminded me of Spaceballs. And then they, of course, they go through with their terrible plan to napalm these guys, and it mutates into a huge blob, which was a bummer to me because the little guys are interesting and I would have liked to see more of a ground fight against them. But now it's a big kaiju blob that has no personality. It's not interesting to look at. It's literally like a moving mountain. And cool, you know, it's got a fucking sphincter at the bottom because of course it does because it's a movie. But that's it. Like, I don't know. It takes all the majesty and all the wonder out of the moment.
Yeah. You see why it works for plot reasons. It needs to have one thing that has absorbed every other kind of, because they showed you so many other little creatures. You're like, well, that would take weeks to mop that up. They're like, no, we're going to make one creature that absorbs every other creature. So one and done. You only have to kill one thing. And like we said, there's another Ghostbusters thing. They wanted it to be something big and they wanted it to be something that pops and splatters everybody with goo. And so they're like, yeah, blob, big blob.
And that's the thing I couldn't shake watching it. I was like, this is not a cool, fun creature. This is a solution to a screenplay problem.
Yeah, that's what it
I'm watching
like.
It like they, yeah. They just didn't know how to write themselves out of this. And they said, make it a blob. That's not fun. That's not engaging.
Yeah. It doesn't have a face. It doesn't have anything. It's just big and purplish brown. And then the scary thing that it's doing is dividing in half. Like we're supposed to see those effects of, oh, the brown thing looks a little more gray, blackish in the middle and it's spreading apart. That is the most sheer horror I've ever faced is watching a big brown blob start to turn into two blobs.
That's mitosis. So scary.
And then the yeah. butt jokes are just, you're so tired of butt jokes by that point and they lean way into them in our Orlando. So it's getting wind in his
sucked
face.
In the butt.
He's getting sucked into yeah. the butt. And he's like, the things I saw and don't like, he tries to play every version of a butt joke there. It's like, oh, I couldn't tell you the things I saw inside that butt. And also, by the way, let me get another joke off. You can't tell anybody where I went. And also it's stinky. Like they're just throwing every butt joke and they're trying to get them all in a short scene.
Well, like Dr. Allison Reed says, often the simplest organism is the strongest. And the butt's a very simple organism, a giant alien butt. So they shoot a bunch of fucking dander shampoo up its ass and it explodes. The end. That was evolution. Wow.
I guess that was one thing I was grateful for is that once they got the hose up the butt, it was over pretty quick. It sprayed a big bunch of goo over everybody. The general got covered in goo. Did you catch that? There's a brief moment where they're hosing the goo off the general, like he got his comeuppance.
I did not, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
It's like a movie where they would have to spray goo off the general. I'm surprised he didn't get sucked into the thing's ass.
That would have been, that would have been funnier, maybe, or at least more of a thing you would want to see coming or happen to him. But yeah, it's almost as if they edited his comeuppance almost completely out, but like the camera swings past him on the way to show our heroes getting their just rewards from the governor. But then our favorites, Ira and Allison, they sneak off in a really crude way. There's like a tender love moment where they kiss, and then it's like, we need to go fuck in the truck. And they're running off as fast as they can to strip down and get it on in the back of the fire truck. I don't know. I found that kind of unpleasant.
When this truck's a rockin'. No, I agree. It felt, I don't know. I understand they're probably riding a high from killing the alien. They probably smell horrible.
Yeah.
It felt out of character for Allison, who's been like so professional the entire movie.
I guess it's that they, like you pointed out earlier, they thought she was somebody else. They thought she was sexually repressed this whole time. And that this man, the very handsome David Duchovny, is unlocking her sexuality. And now, as they get through this moment of crisis, she is becoming who she wanted to be, a fully sexual woman. But like none of us saw her that way. So it just looked like these two people who at this moment where they seem to be earning the fame and scientific notoriety that they craved are like, actually, you know what? Fucking is better than science. Let's go fuck.
That's one of the few things I can agree with them on. Fucking is better than science. Put that on my gravestone. All right. You want to hear some tidbits about the people involved in the movie and where they went from here?
Yeah.
So Duchovny actually turned down a role in episode 2, Attack of the Clones of the Star Wars prequel saga to be in this movie. I have no idea what his role was. That's under lock and key up at the Lucasfilm Ranch. So this is all from IMDb trivia, so take it with a grain of salt. They say John Cusack and Leonardo DiCaprio were considered for the role of Ira Kane. I'm sure Leonardo DiCaprio was considered for the role of Ira Kane in the same way that Ana de Armas is considered for the role of my girlfriend. Sure, that'd be nice. It's not happening. John Cusack, I could see, though. I feel like he could have, but he's got very similar energy to Duchovny to me, like a very smarmy, smartest guy in the room thing going on. I don't feel like it would have been a vastly different movie with Cusack in the role.
No, it would have worked pretty similar.
Jennifer Aniston was considered for the role of Allison. I think Julianne Moore is overall a better actress than her, but Aniston's probably a little more comfortable in comedy. So I wonder how that would have played.
She might have been able to find some version of that character that made sense to us. Julianne Moore was so normal in this.
Could have been fun. They clearly greenlit a animated series thinking this is going to be a big hit. And that didn't happen. But they still went through with the animated series.
They thought it was Ghostbusters, man. They followed the Ghostbusters blueprint, which includes a successful kids animated show.
I love that Ghostbusters cartoon. I have not watched any of this. Alienators Evolution Continues had 26 episodes. None of the original actors returned to do the voices, but the characters were the same.
Oh, so why would fucking kids care about this shit? This was like the furthest thing from that. I guess in some ways Ghostbusters was too, but Ghostbusters somehow managed to transcend and work both ways, but this thing did not.
Also, Ghostbusters 2, I think, came out before the animated series, and that was more childish and kid-friendly.
Yeah, so they eased into that audience.
Duchovny followed this up with a cameo in Zoolander, which he's great in. I love that cameo as the hand model.
Oh, I got to go back. It's been so many years, I can't picture him.
But why male models? Are you serious? I just told you. I think Zoolander might qualify for the pod.
It was
right around 9/11. Nobody wanted to watch it because, you know, nobody wanted to laugh at that time. But yeah, it did not do great. So we might be able to cover it one day. It might be bending the rules a little bit. But then he got a lead role in probably Steven Soderbergh's worst movie, Full Frontal, which is a send up of sleazy Hollywood studio executives, which is very resonant today.
Yeah.
It was not warmly received at the time. It was a huge bomb.
Okay.
He then wrote, directed, starred in a movie called House of D, a coming of age dramedy that made no money and got terrible reviews. And then the movies were like, that's enough for you, buddy. This ain't working out. So he went back to TV. He did Californication from 2007 to 2014. So that was clearly a nice steady paycheck. And it's a show some people like. I have not watched a lot of it. I have no ill will towards it, but it doesn't seem like my thing. And then some show about a serial killer called Aquarius from 2015 to 2016. I had never heard of that show before researching for this podcast. I have no idea if it's good or not. And then he did two more seasons of The X-Files. I think it was a 10th and 11th season, 2016 to 2018. And he's still working. He was in The Bubble, that movie that just came out, the Judd Apatow Netflix movie. And he's in a Kenya Barris directed movie, You People. It's in post-production. So that'll probably be coming either later this year or early next year.
Those are good people to work with. So it sounds like he's still in the good side of Hollywood.
Yeah, but I think he had to give up being a leading man and just be a guy in these movies. And that's, he could probably either make some shittier movies that he's the lead of or be in some better stuff that you got to be like fourth build, third build. But if it was me, I'd want to be in better stuff with maybe a smaller role. So I think he's taken that path now.
Sounds like it.
He's also a singer-songwriter. He's put out 3 albums, most recently in 2021. Gesture Land is his most recent album.
Wow. Some stiff competition for Jeff Bridges and Jeremy Renner out there.
And Vin Diesel, let's not forget.
And Vin Diesel with the fucking EDM shit.
Yeah. I have not listened to it. Maybe before this episode comes out, I'll listen to some and tweet it out, one of his better songs if he has any.
Should we promise a show notes link to a Duchovny?
Fuck it. We're going to do it. I'm going to find David Duchovny's best song and I'll put the YouTube link in the show notes. Orlando Jones, he did some movies after this, but no really big ones. Stuff you've heard of, but he was also not the star of necessarily. He was in Drumline, Biker Boys, Runaway Jury, Primeval. Primeval is a killer alligator movie that was hilariously marketed as being like about a serial killer. It was like the most prolific serial killer in world history. And it's about like an alligator or a crocodile. I can't remember which. And people were pissed because they were like, I wanted to see a serial killer movie. It was a fucking gator.
They literally fooled the audience with a little verbal twist.
Yeah. Which one gets bigger? Crocodiles or alligators?
Oh, no. I pictured little crocodiles and big alligators, but I may be totally off on that.
Me too. I think saltwater crocodiles get really big because it was about like a African crocodile or alligator that was called Gustav. That was eating people. I remember the name of the thing, but not if it was a crocodile or an alligator. My brain is so fucked. He hosted a late night show for one season in 2003. I had no idea. But he's done a lot of TV work, sometimes one-offs on shows like Everybody Hates Chris, Pushing Daisies, New Amsterdam. He's had recurring roles and stuff like Rules of Engagement, The Good Lord Bird, which was quite good, and LA's Finest. And he's been like on the main cast of shows like Sleepy Hollow and the aforementioned American Gods. Yeah. I liked the first season of Sleepy Hollow quite a bit, but it went off the rails after a while.
Okay.
Sean William Scott, we covered pretty in depth on the Rundown episode, so I don't want to rehash all that. I'll just catch you up on what he's done since then. He starred as Father Joe on Welcome to Flatch, a Fox mockumentary sitcom that I've never heard of, but it was just renewed for a season 2 and it's coming in September.
Wild.
It's supposed to be not terrible. I don't know. I might check it out because I'm a Sean William Scott fan, as you know.
How can he play a father or a priest or whatever that character is when he's merely a high school kid? He's just a little young man.
He's just a young rapscallion. No good, Nick. cruising for pussy. I don't think I need to tell anyone what Julianne Moore's been up to. She's one of our finest actresses. She's a treasure. She won an Oscar for Best Actress in 2015 for Still Alice.
Oh, cool.
She works constantly. She was in 4 movies in 2021, including future episode Dear Evan Hansen.
Wow.
And she starred in the Stephen King miniseries Lizzie Story in 2021, okay. Which was also pretty good.
Juicy roles. A lot of shit's going to go down if you're the star of a Stephen King story.
I like my Stephen King stuff told in miniseries form.
Yeah.
So it's a good vessel for his writing because he tends to sprawl. We covered Ivan Reitman in a pretty recent episode, and obviously he has not made anything else because he passed away. But if you want more of a catch up on his career, you can listen to our draft day episode. We go into it a little more in depth there. So the movie opened, like I mentioned, in fourth place, 13.4 million. Swordfish took first place. Second place was Shrek in its fourth week.
Okay.
Made $16.5 million. Third place was Pearl Harbor in its third week with $14.2 million. Fucking Pearl Harbor. God, I wish that movie lost money so I could shit on it for an hour and a half. But alas, it did too well. So it would drop to sixth place in its second week with $6.6 million, giving up a lot of ground to Lara Croft Tomb Raider, which is the first Angelina Jolie Tomb Raider movie that made $47.7 million in its debut.
Wild. That seems like that was a bomb.
Yeah, it felt like it was a real shit movie, but
yeah.
It's not.
Because people wanted to find out for themselves.
Yeah. Atlantis, The Lost Empire went wide that week too and made $20.3 million. So like if you were going to see an adventure movie, you've got two pretty good options right there.
Yeah.
Lara Croft and Atlantis. And then it kept dropping the following week, only making $3.2 million. The Fast and the Furious, the original Fast and Furious, and Dr. Dolittle 2 came out that week and took the top spot. So it had some stiff competition, but it was clearly a big disappointment for them, releasing it right at the beginning of June, which we know June is blockbuster season.
They went through all the motions. They really thought, okay, you know what? We're just going to do Ghostbusters again. It's going to kick ass. It's going to have all the appeal. It's going to have all the spinoffs, the toys, the animated series, the huge summer blockbuster success. But none of it clicked and none of it really worked. This movie has some charms, but it was never going to be that. And it's weird to think that so many people were caught up in the idea that you could just replicate that success.
They went through all the motions. None of the Ghostbusters were huge names when they made the movie. So they similarly went with known actors, but not the guys you would expect to kick start a franchise. They threw a bunch of money at it. They had a bunch of people work on the script, but they forgot to make that movie. At the end of the day, Ghostbusters worked because it was a good movie. Like you said, evolution has its charms, and I will not say that I hate this movie. Nostalgia is certainly coloring my perception of it, but I still had a good time watching it this time. I was just much more aware of its problems. It's not that movie. It's not the smash hit. You probably could have halved the budget and done okay telling a smaller story.
Yeah, you should have. This movie didn't deserve the investment that it got. It should have just been a little scrappy indie sci-fi comedy. And instead, it decided it was going to be a blockbuster.
Yeah, either be a $40 million sci-fi comedy or an $80 million action sci-fi horror.
With a sense of humor, but not this kind of body butt joke sexist comedy.
Yeah, there's two good movies they could have made here. And they kind of half-assed it and made the shitty one in the middle of the two of them. So no real surprise why it didn't catch on as much. But I'm happy it still has a following. Again, it's got a pretty winning cast. They do as much as they could to make it enjoyable. The creature designs are pretty cool.
Yeah.
Phil Tippett, terrible at supervising dinosaurs, but pretty good at designing little critters.
Yeah, not bad.
And yeah, it's still a favorite of mine. It's not a favorite of mine. It's
that's staying in.
No, I won't be able to look back on it as fondly anymore now that I've watched it as an adult. But I certainly think it has a place. It just wasn't what they thought it was.
If you take it as a weird, dumb, bad idea movie, you can enjoy it.
There is truly some good stuff in here, but just most of it, the movie's not as interested in digging deeper into. It wants to stay on the surface level with the butt jokes.
And in the spirit of bad jokes, I have a final thought to share, if you would allow me.
Of course.
All I wanted to say is that I have now thoroughly studied evolution, and if I were you, I would naturally select a different movie to watch.
Oh boy, you got that one. It's the last shitty Darwin joke you get. So that was Evolution. What do we got for you next week? It's our 4th of July episode.
Wow.
I mean, it's dropping on June 29th because the 4th of July is not really close to a Wednesday. We don't want to drop a 4th of July episode after the 4th of July.
No, everybody will be hungover and sunburned and they won't want to hear anything about it for a whole year.
So we're doing a movie. When we started this podcast, I think it might have been the first Apple podcast review we ever got said, I really wish they would do Independence Day Resurgence. And I've always remembered that. We dropped the ball last 4th of July. So we're doing it this time.
The anticipation is crazy. Our fan base of one has been waiting for this movie.
I hope whoever that was st- still listens to the podcast.
And God, let's hope so.
Because they will be very pleased. Spoiler alert, I have seen this movie before. I fucking hate it. Don't tune in if you're a big fan of that movie and you don't want your feelings hurt. I'm going to shit all over it.
You don't know. What if I love it? What if it's the best movie I've ever seen?
I'm going to fly to California and fucking punch you in the dick. No, I might be overstating how bad it is, but it has no idea what people liked about the original Independence Day and none of its charm. But in a weird way, I'm looking forward to watching it again because there's nothing more fun than getting real mad about a movie.
Crack open a cold beer, put some dogs on the grill, and we're going to go to town.
All right. So thank you guys so much for listening. I already told you how to help support the podcast at the top of the episode, but you can also follow us on Twitter at BlastZonePod. Yeah. Email us blastzonepod@gmail.com. And thanks so much for listening.
We'll see you next time in the Blast Zone.